Welcome to Let It Roll, the story of how and why rock and roll happened with Ed Ward and Nate Wilcox. It's time to let it roll. I'm Nate Wilcox, and today we're going to talk to biographer Paul Trinka about his book, Brian Jones, The Making of the Rolling Stones. I've been obsessed with Brian's tragic story for 30 years, and Trinka's book is the definitive one on the subject. As always, you can access our YouTube playlists and learn more about the episodes on our website, letitrollpodcast.com. This week, Paul and I talk about the brutal rivalries at the heart of the Rolling Stones, who originally brought the mojo to the band, Brian and Keith Richards' legendary guitar weaving, and much more. Pop in those earbuds and enjoy. Welcome to the Let It Roll podcast. We've got something a little bit different today. Ed Ward is busy beavering away on volume 2 of his History of Rock and Roll. So I've invited one of my favorite rock writers, Paul Trinka, who's been generous enough to sit down and talk with us. He's the author of Brian Jones, The Making of the Rolling Stones, David Bowie's Starman, Iggy, Open Up and Bleed, and Portrait of the Blues, as well as a longtime editor of Mojo Magazine. So I'm hoping to talk about all of that with Paul. Paul, welcome.
Hey, it's great to be here. Thanks, Nate.
Cool. And so first up, I want to talk about the Brian Jones book. That's the most recent of your books. And Brian Jones, for whatever reason, this has always been a morbid obsession of mine as long as I've been aware of the Stones. What motivated you to write a book about Brian Jones?
I've always been fascinated by the early history of the Stones and actually didn't think there was a definitive account of their origins, really. And Brian fascinated me because I've done enough stories on the Stones, spoken to them enough over the years to realize he was an inspirational visionary figure whilst also being a very flawed human being. And I'd looked at the other books, and in my arrogant, you know, Mojo editor kind of way, none of them satisfied me. For a start, none of them really spoke about the music. You know, here's the guy who first played slide guitar, was the first electric slide guitarist in the UK and Europe, the first white one, that is, and probably, you know, beat any American rivals to the throne. So he was a fascinating figure, and I thought it hadn't been done. So it was a kind of an easy choice for me, really.
And how much of it was a response to, frankly, Keith Richards' belittling of Jones and his legacy in his autobiography, Life?
Life was in many ways an immediate spur, because Keith spent so much time putting down Brian and saying he wasn't important, that it had the opposite effect for me of that intended. To me, it felt that Brian was really important and that Keith was in denial, and not necessarily denial because of ego, although that was a part of it. I think they went through a lot of pain together as kids, really. You know, they abused each other like it's like a pack of wild dogs in many ways. So, yeah, Life to me was felt like somebody damaged writing about somebody else who was very damaged and in denial. And I thought it was not a very just book. You know, how many of us are really just and fair about other people? Well, we try to be, don't we? And you know, there's a certain credibility. And whilst I was happy that Keith's book did well, you know, it got people talking about music, I thought it was a really, really flawed book and shallow. You know, there were some terrific bits in it, but I felt that his the kind of narrative, the Keith that came out, you know, was a creation. It wasn't really that honest. I think Keith's writing through a kind of veil of poor memory, you know, the drugs over the years that you know, the hangers on. And that's not to put the guy down, because I've got a lot of affection for him. But yeah, it wasn't just or fair, and I didn't feel it did the history right. He didn't even remember the name of the drummer on their first gig, you know, so I thought it was time for me to put another perspective.
And that's much appreciated, especially by those of us who, for whatever reason, are Brian Jones obsessions. I mean, I love the Stones, but there's something special about Brian that, you know, even though he basically was either checked out or dead for their absolute pinnacle, the Beggar's Banquet to Exile Main Street period. I mean, he contributed to Beggars, but after that, faded out and was dead for the big part. But what is it about Brian that you think was something lost in the Stones' later work without Brian, and how much of their later legacy was set by him?
Well, I guess I say in the book that Brian kind of gave them their mojo, and they were operating on a residual mojo after he died. You know, so in some ways, in some real ways, they were still doing what he taught them, and they had a certain amount. They had freedom after, you know, he'd been to some extent a dead weight in the studio, a dead weight that they'd created. But all the tools they were using were ones he'd, you know, he'd shown them, and there was that edge to everything they did with him, and then the immediate albums afterwards. But what you can really tell is that they were musically conservative, and Brian was musically adventurous. And while he was there, they pushed. And, you know, they kept on pushing up to Exile on Main Street because Brian had helped put them at the cutting edge. And thereafter, you know, Keith had his open G tuning, and he played riffs in open G tuning for another, you know, 40 years afterwards. And they've probably made less progress in the subsequent 40 years than they did in, you know, the 7 years or so with Brian. So, you know, I love those later albums too, but they bear the stamp of Brian. But they, once they lost that sense of adventure and maybe chaos he gave them, it was really diminishing returns thereafter. That, and yeah, so, you know, for me, the magic went. And I love Sticky Fingers, which is, you know, an album that was made after Brian. But if Brian hadn't existed, that album wouldn't have been made.
Yeah, and how much do you view them? I mean, one of the themes in your work is this tension between singer-songwriters like David Bowie and Iggy Pop or Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf versus sidemen like Brian Jones or Ron Ashton, James Williamson, Hubert Sumlin. How much of that sort of tension, I mean, what was the twist for you? And your previous books had been from the perspective of the singer-songwriter. What was the flip going and writing from the perspective of the sideman, the accompanist?
That's a really good question, actually. And it is an area that interests me. And few people have commented on that before. But for me, the story of Iggy Pop was really how his fellow bandmate Matt made Iggy Pop. That is not to denigrate, you know, his genius, because he took these elements from these other people and he put them, he kind of focused them and marketed them and sold them and embodied them. But he would have never been, Jim Osterberg would have never become Iggy Pop without meeting the Stooges, the Dum Dum Boys. And I guess in exactly the same way, Brian was the true outcast, and Mick Jagger and Keith, they took a lot of Brian's elements and they incorporated that into their own persona in exactly the same way that Iggy had taken on Dave Alexander and Ron Ashton and subsumed those into his own persona. Remember, these are kind of middle-class boys. They're not really on the edge. You know, Jimmy Osterberg was the school pupil at Tappan Junior High, voted most likely to succeed. You know, people thought he might become president of the USA. So he took that edge from Ron Ashton and Mick Jagger, who, let's remember, didn't give up his place at the LSE, at the London School of Economics, till the Stones actually had a record in the charts. He took that edge mainly from Brian Jones. To some extent, you know, the Keith Richards that we know today, he took elements from Brian Jones. The voice that Keith has now is kind of Brian Jones's voice. And the clothing that he wore from 1967, 1968, that, you know, they were Brian Jones's voice. But I guess sometimes when we steal something, we steal an element of somebody else, we can commercialize it a bit more, strip it down and lose the bit that make him a bit of a mess. Because poor Ron Ashton, you know, man who I think, you know, was a genius in his own way. Iggy left him and Ron more or less stayed on the sofa for the next 30 or 40 years. And Brian didn't have that ambition. You know, he didn't have the right kind of ambition that Mick Jagger in particular had. But those guys took stuff from Brian. And you know what? That theft is not a criminal act. That's what happens in creativity. It's only somewhat critical when you don't give credit to the people whose life and work you've appropriated.
Yeah, and that's one thing that's fascinating about the Stones. I mean, in a way, it's very true to the brand that Brian established for them not to be sentimental about him, to not be kind to his memory. I mean, they're the opposite of the Beatles. The Beatles were always about, we love everybody. And, you know, they helped George reach this culmination as a singer-songwriter and even promoted Ringo as a star in his own right. Whereas the Stones was very much more a vicious competition internally. And, you know, it's pretty clear from reading your book and other accounts of Brian's life that he set that tone. I mean, he was the original cruel person.
Yeah, gotcha. Again, very good point. I guess they've kept true to his values, which were of competition, you know, one-upmanship, rivalry, and a kind of insecurity as well. You know, the contrast between the culture of the Stones and the Beatles is a shocking one, and I think it's one that doesn't really come out generally when people talk about them. And it's part of their magic, really, the nastiness and the cruelty, you know, that they would, you know, the Let's Spend the Night Together video shows Brian a mess, you know, when he's facing drugs charges. That's pretty extreme. But I guess that's at the heart of their best music. You know, it's kind of it's not really loving music, is it? It's disturbing. There's definitely some sand in the oyster, and he set that up. So I guess you're right. It's kind of true to the image. And, you know, for me, somebody's, I guess, been around a lot of the people who were around the Beatles and Stones for a long time now. I mean, it's weird in retrospect to think that I've met a lot of Beatles people over the years, and then a lot of Stones people and been around the Stones group. People did say, Tony Bramwell in particular said he didn't really like enjoy spending time with the Stones. He said the Beatles had nice people around them and the Stones had nasty people.
Yeah, and that's very much something that Brian and Keith in particular had this fascination, you know, with hard men, and Andrew Lloyd Goldham as well, you know, with Reg the Bodyguard and figures like that, their relationship with Kenneth Anger, the occultist and director. And Brian was very much, you know, the leader on that path. And what do you think of is Brian's biggest legacy beyond the Stones? I mean, is it that he's the founder of the 27 Club and the architect type of the doomed rock star?
No, I think the 27 Club is, you know, it's a nice little marketing tool. But to me, you know, Brian is the first one who put that edge and those kind of blue notes into British pop music. You know, you think about the Beatles before, it's all very major key. It's all very Chuck Berry. And then that modal edge, that kind of bluesy edge, that slide guitar, that kind of distortion, that comes from Brian. You know, Brian in 1961, 1962 got that sound down. You know, he listened to Elmore James, he stuck a pickup on his acoustic and shoved it through a Vox AC-15, and he was the first one really to get that distortion. And if you listen to the first demos they did with him, and especially if you listen to their version of I Want to Be Your Man, which is the one where he had kind of free reign in the studio, it was his arrangement. Andrew Lou Goldham had crashed after a bit of a manic depressive episode. And that edge, you know, once it was in the ether, the universe, there was no putting it back. And he was the first one. You know, plenty of other people had, you know, made their other advances in music. But I think there's an absolutely convincing case that Brian was the first to unleash that kind of blues aggression and that blue and nastiness and that sound. And that really defined nearly all of, you know, British music beyond that. It really made a difference. Maybe somebody else could have done it later on if he hadn't, but he was the first guy to do it.
Yeah, and to me, you can really hear that in the work of the Kinks and Ray Davies and The Who and Pete Townsend, that they were clearly listening to I Want to Be Your Man because they went right after that guitar tone.
Yeah, exactly. And it's a really pumped up sound. It's kind of eyeball popping. It's distorted. It's compressed. And it's kind of a bit relentless. It's very repetitive. You know, so I hear a lot of American garage rock in there as well. I hear exactly that really compressed sound that Shel Talmy went for with the Who and the the Kinks. Tonally, that was the first one. And I don't think it's insignificant that of all the American punk bands, including Ron Ashton, you know, it was Brian Jones who was the icon, because he had that edge. He had that kind of beauty, and then he had that nastiness to him as well. And I do say in the book, and maybe it's kind of over philosophical, but nonetheless, you know, there's this myth about the god Pan, and he introduced kind of distortion and a kind of atonal element into music, and that's what gave it its kind of sexiness and its appeal. And Brian saw himself as a Pan figure, and there are certain people, and we're going a little bit esoteric here, he saw him as a manifestation of the god Pan. So when I, the British title of the book is Sympathy for the Devil, and it's not the devil, it's not Satan, it's a little devil, it's Pan. You know, he's not a good boy, but he's unleashed this amazing cornucopia of music. And that's what Brian symbolizes to me on a kind of visual front, and then definitely on a sonic front as well.
I think that's an excellent summation. And one thing that I think is a common theme between Brian Jones and David Bowie is this, they functioned as sort of a retroactive rock critic, in that before Brian Jones comes along, you know, if you look into the Beatles' early history, especially Mark Lewisohn's work at documenting this stuff so well, or if you look into what Elvis Presley's influences were, or Little Richard's, it's more, you know, Louis Jordan and Jump Blues and Wynonie Harris and Roy Brown and guys like that, whereas Brian and the Stones create this shift and sort of retroactively erase that history and put in there Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf and Robert Johnson and the blues tradition. And that ever since then, that's been the accepted history of rock and roll.
I think that's a really good point. Again, when you listen to the Beatles stuff, I was in a shop the other day and they were playing I'll Get You by the Beatles. It's a great song. You know, it's very sort of up-tempo, but it's very, very major. And then, you know, it doesn't sound unlike Freddie and the Dreamers, a band that I don't have a lot of time for. It's like a good version of Freddie and the Dreamers, but it's very, you can, it's very Buddy Holly. It's very British Music Hall. And there's no real darkness or edge to it at all. They had that sometime, but it's not there. And the Stones kind of shifted. You know, there's a kind of tipping point where they kind of shifted the axis to something darker and dirtier. And the Brits, for some reason, were really good at it. You know, that Brian was the first. A lot of other people, let's say Jimmy Page and others, really had an ear for it. Clapton, likewise, with the first Blues Breakers album, went for that edge, which generally wasn't around in pop music. So that, you know, the kind of sonic character of everything really changed. And for them to find that, to tap into this stuff that was very esoteric, you know, it was collector's music. It was kind of weirdo collectors, a bit like video collectors who want something a bit darker and a bit more violent. And Keith was certainly into that stuff, although Keith was the Chuck Berry dude. But it was Brian who latched on to Robert Johnson, especially, about whom there's something darker in the sound. And uniquely in the Stones, it was Brian who actually thought this music would be commercial. The other Stones just thought, hey, it'll be... it's kind of cool. It's student music. Yeah, we'll do this for a couple of years. It's like hip art student music. And it was Brian who desperately wanted to be a star. He kind of thought, this is my ticket. You know, I'm going to be a star. And there was that kind of madness and desperation about it. And that's what drove the Stones. If he hadn't been the one pushing with this angst, they wouldn't have been the band they were.
Go ahead.
He was kind of like the John Lennon and the George Harrison of the Stones. You know, the roles overlap, but Paul Dunoyer from Mojo, I remember a really good review of maybe the Lewisohn book, where he talked about Lennon being the first guy to cotton onto angst. So when we listen to people like Kurt Cobain, that kind of whole aura of being unhappy, you know, of being in pain, that, you know, John did unleash it, but Brian was a crucial part of that in the Stones as well. He just communicated it in a different way because he wasn't a singer.
And one thing about one of, I think, Brian's legacies that maybe you underplay in the book a little bit, but to me, you know, Robert Palmer talks about this a lot in his biography of the Stones. There's this big split behind the scenes in 1968 where Brian is obsessed with Moroccan music and Mick and Keith really want to get back to the blues. And Brian loses that fight. I mean, he's psychically crippled at that point, and his second drugs arrest in May of 68 finishes him. But to me, Jimmy Page, who had worked with Brian on the soundtrack for the Anita Pallenberg movie Brian did the soundtrack to, as well as on Nico's first solo record, Jimmy Page is the one who picks up that thread. And to me, records like Kashmir and so much of the stuff Led Zeppelin did on Physical Graffiti, that to me, Brian is part of the torch passing of that.
I think that's a very plausible argument, actually. It is perhaps one I should have stressed, maybe because I wasn't instinctively a Led Zepp fan, and I had so many kind of points to make in the book. I would have loved to have got Jimmy Page. He's made very, you know, and really spoken to him about what went on, because I know he thinks of Brian as a visionary, and I definitely see that as a torch that passed from one to the other. And you're right, you know, the they did take on that Moroccan sound. The one time I saw Page and Plant at Glastonbury in about 1997, they were great when they had a kind of a string orchestra behind them playing all these very modal Moroccan, you know, string lines. It was fantastic. And, you know, Brian was responsible for that. But of course, there was a bigger thing as well, where, you know, he brought the notion of world music is a kind of patronizing term, because it packages all these disparate cultures up in one little bag. But if we're going to use that term, you know, Brian was the first one to realize, you know, this is kind of the same. This is rock and roll. You know, we've incorporated blues into all of that. We can take this stuff in. And I think, again, he was really visionary in incorporating that. So, and it goes beyond, you know, people like Peter Gabriel or whoever. You know, there's been so many bits of disparate African and even folk music brought, and obscure folk music's brought into all of today's, you know, kind of pop culture. And he was the first guy to kind of commit to it.
Yeah. And one thing I think that Brian's focus, one of the reasons he's sort of like a dark star that's hidden, is that one of his gifts was this fascination with sound. Like he says in some of his interviews while he was alive, you know, I'm into the sound of things, whether it's church bells or the tone of a blues guitar. And he really was the first English musician to capture that sonic tone of the early blues records. And then his fascination with Moroccan music. I mean, it's that raunchy sound of those Arabic drones and horns. And he brings that into the Satanic Majesty's era of the Stones music very well. But, you know, his sort of second great awakening or creative period in the Stones is when he becomes this multi-instrumentalist. You know, he's on the marimbas or he's playing the dulcimer, early innovator on the mellotron. I mean, how much of that fascination with sound, I mean, why is that legacy not appreciated more, I guess, is my question.
It's a really good point, because I think if you think about the year 1967 and how the Brits got to it, you know, Brian was really one of the key movers, because the whole possibilities of sound had opened up, you know, and you could use anything. And Brian was the one in many ways who used the kind of recording studio as a musical instrument in itself, just realizing when you come to a session, you add these shades and these tones, it takes the music in a different place. And it does sadden me that he's often just seen as the kind of weird guy or the dead guy in the Stones. But, you know, the Beatles were exploring these extreme sonic possibilities, but Brian was plausibly taking it further. And although George played the sitar before Brian did, you know, George's sitar was like Indian, you know, it was recognizably Indian, whereas with Brian, the sitar was just a part of the whole, you know. And he did theoretically come up with how sitar would fit in with, you know, the Stones' pentatonic scales. So even whilst he was stoned a lot of the time, there was a lot of real kind of sonic wisdom and understanding of the bigger picture. And of course, exactly the same things happens with the marimbas as well. So all the edge and the invention is, I think, really underappreciated. And it's important to have to think about people like Eddie Kramer, the guy who was responsible for so much of Jimi Hendrix's great recordings. And he, you know, he thought that Brian was the visionary within the Stones. When he was there in the studio, even when Brian was in the mess, it's kind of Brian who added the magic. And yeah, he doesn't get credit for that. But then again, you know, his fellow Stones have been dissing him for 40 years, and that does have an effect.
And speaking of credit, like one of the things that I think Brian Jones partisans obsess over is, other than the Nankervelde group credit for songwriting, which he shared in, he gets no credit for songs like The Last Time, where he wrote the distinctive riff, or Paint It Black, where he probably wrote the melody line that Mick Jagger, I mean, his sitar and Mick Jagger's vocal melody are the same tune. Mm. And, you know, Lady Jane, others like that. Well, I mean, how much, or Under My Thumb, you know, where Bill Wyman says, you know, before Brian's part, it wasn't really a song, now was it? How much of that do you think, I mean, do you think he deserved songwriting credit on some of those tunes?
2 points, really. Yes, he did deserve credit. Secondly, he needed to ask for it, and he didn't. You know, so if we were to talk about his flaws, a bad negotiator doesn't ask for something and then complains they don't get it, and that's what Brian did. Whereas good negotiator, I'm thinking when I dealt with Yoko Ono on Mojo, and we were doing a Lennon issue in conjunction with her, and she came back to me, played really hardball, and said, "I want this, I want this, I want to see this article about so and so, and then I'm going to help you," and then we came out and said, no, you can have this, you can have this. You can't see that article. You can actually write a thing about your response to this article, which was about the Goldman book. And that's all we can do. And she said, fine. And at the end, she sent us all little notes to say thank you. She asked for what she wanted. She got most of it. And she showed gratitude, whereas Brian didn't ask for what he wanted and felt bad about it. And we can't just blame his fellow Stones. You know, he has to take, you know, he just needed to be more assertive. But of course, he wasn't that kind of guy. He was flawed, and it was his flaws that defined him, for better or worse.
Yeah, I mean, if you compare Brian to, say, Dave Clark, who got all the money from the Dave Clark Five and co-songwriting credit when, you know, Mike Smith probably wrote the majority, you know, of the melodies and chords of those songs. But, you know, Brian never had financial backing, and he didn't have the sense. You know, early on, he argues and gets a £5 a week pay over what the rest of the Stones. And in his mind, it's for being the spokesman. But if he had just asked for credit as a arranger on their records, that would have been a very lucrative thing, like it was for Alan Price of the Animals. And it would have been deserved.
It would have been, but remember, it was kind of three against one, because we have Andrew Oldham, who himself was trying to get control of Mick and Keith, and he did so by disparaging Brian a lot of the time. And of course, he found Brian unreliable. I mean, actually, the other guys weren't particularly reliable. Certainly, Andrew Oldham wasn't reliable. But there were, you know, obviously, there is a pattern there. It's a pattern that happens in a lot of rock music, where it's kind of, if you've paid for the session, you own the song, and there's a hierarchy there, and it is unfair, and it happens. You know, it's hard to know how to react to it, because it, you know, it happens all the time. But if you just let it go on, then maybe, you know, you're conniving, you're responsible. It's like seeing a kind of abuse going on and not doing anything. And yeah, it was a ripoff, and it's shameful. And, you know, I think it's on a couple of Nankervelde songs that were banned songs. You know, my understanding is that some of them have been re-credited as Jagger Richards songs. And, you know, why is that happening without any oversight? Of course, there's nobody really looking after, you know, Brian Jones's estate aggressively. And that's a shame, because if we might, you know, we talk about people like Howlin' Wolf or Hubert Sumlin. They were ripped off big time. You know, there might have been Jimmy Page could have inadvertently borrowed a couple of their riffs. But then they had hotshot lawyers who went in, got them their money, took a slice of it and got them the money. And that's probably what Brian needed. He needed somebody zealous to deal with the likes of Andrew Oldham and Alan Klein. But I guess, it, you know, this is the rock music in the early days. Plenty of people got ripped off. You know, the Animals, the Kinks, a lot of their money disappeared into the Bermuda or some or the Cayman Islands or elsewhere. It isn't unusual, but there is Brian's treatment is unjust, and it continues.
Yeah, but you also make it very clear throughout the book that Brian brings most of this on himself. I mean, his the lack of an heir to his estate to manage it. I mean, in one part, it's because of his terrible relationship with his parents, which they obviously were partly responsible for as well. And then also his treatment of his children, which none of his children were acknowledged. You know, he treated them all as bastards that he, you know, briefly would be involved in their lives, but, you know, then cut himself off pretty cruelly from all of them. So, you know, the karma there is pretty clear. How do you deal as a writer with telling the story of somebody who's, you know, I mean, Keith sums him up as he wasn't a good guy. And he wasn't in a lot of ways. He was, you know, Keith at another point says he was such a beautiful cat in some ways, but such an asshole in others. How do you tell the story of somebody like that?
It's a tough one, really, except we're all human beings with our baggage and we're all damaged. And, you know, a lot of the cruel things we do are because, you know, we're damaged in our own sense. And I didn't want to, you know, retrospectively absolve Brian of his sins. And I really, you know, I really made sure I detailed his betrayal of a lot of people. And with Linda Leach's or Linda Lawrence's kid, Julian, you know, they did turn up to see Brian when he was there with Marianne Faithful. And they were, and they were just, you know, they were mocking him. It's completely awful. And, you know, I'm a dad. I love having kids. It's a joy, and it's something that stretches you as a human being. And he was incapable of doing that because he was so innately selfish. But then many artists throughout history are, and I don't think we should absolve them of what they've done. But nonetheless, you know, the psychology is interesting, how they got to that place. And when you are turning over conventional norms, you're often a very flawed person. You know, I think in both the Iggy and the Bowie books, for much of the time, they weren't very kind people. Bowie, I think, ended up being kind once he was kind of successful and a lot of his demons were exorcised. But unfortunately, a lot of the people who make art is, you know, can be selfish. And they're needy, and they think about themselves all the time. And it's always a phenomenon that's unsettling, but fascinating, because it, you know, it's often the flawed personalities who make the great art. And I guess I see my role as saying this is what happened, and for people to make their own judgment about the balance of kind of blame that we assign to them, and then credit for the music that they've made that's transformative and can transform people's lives for the good.
Yeah, I mean, that's one thing that comes through reading the different books, that, you know, Brian is this sort of completely unredeemed. I mean, he never had a chance to mature as a person. He died so young and never – he was the most generous musically of the Stones and supported other acts, but he ends up very much isolated and alone and unloved, whereas Bowie in particular – is able, I mean, his generosity to Iggy Pop, you know, it's very clear in the Iggy book that Bowie pulled Iggy off the garbage heap twice, and maybe even three times if you consider, you know, all the royalties that he made sure Iggy got. And it's really remarkable how generous Bowie was with Iggy. And then by the end of their lives, Iggy had spurned Bowie.
Yeah, very true. I was chatting to somebody about who was thinking about a movie on the 27 Club, and he was saying that in certain cultures, might be Buddhist ones, you don't really achieve wisdom until you're 27. You know, he theorized that it was a very kind of loaded year psychically. Once you're 27, once you've got to that point, then you start to grow as a human being and assume more responsibilities. And, you know, there are other people who theorize that the way the brain works, it works in a different way, you know, for when you're 27. I mean, it's hard to say with Brian because he consumed so many drugs in the interim that you know, that certainly the function of his brain was most certainly affected. But everybody can redeem themselves. And as you say, Brian didn't get the chance.
And so one last thing about Brian I want to bring up is his decline as a guitarist. Now, he blossoms as this multi-instrumentalist, but there's a clear decline from his playing from, say, 63, 64, when he's right up neck and neck with Keith. And you document, you know, the way from the live tapes of 66, 67, that Brian's playing is competent longer than perhaps a lot of people thought. Like, I personally had thought that after he broke his hand allegedly attempting to punch Anita Pallenberg, that his playing never really recovered. But you show, and I've listened to the tapes myself, and it's clear in 67 he could still play guitar, but by 68 there's this marked decline. And by the time you hear his version of Honky Tonk Woman, I mean, he's not even a competent rhythm guitarist at that point. What do you think happened?
I think he was addicted to the new, you know, so it was more about discovering an instrument than maintaining it. He didn't have the same kind of work ethic that Keith had either, because I think it's on the Peter Whitehead movie in Ireland. You see Keith is playing guitar all the time. So he's kind of overtaking Brian. And I think Brian wanted to be top dog. You know, he was an egotist, just like they were. If he wasn't going to be the best guitarist, then he'd do something else. There's definitely that element too. And, you know, I think he didn't, you know, he didn't have the focus that Keith had, but he was addicted to the new and found that other stuff more exciting. You know, in retrospect, if I had a time machine, I'd go back and say, keep on doing this. But all that said, listen to No Expectations, listen to that acoustic slide guitar on there, and tell me if it isn't absolutely perfect.
Yeah, I mean, that's a beautiful sort of last testament. And I think, you know, his fingerprints are all over the Beggar's Banquet album, and he makes a big impact on Street Fighting Man with his sitar. And I think his playing is audible and a big part of Jumpin' Jack Flash as well. The way that the bridge, rather than, you know, most guitarists would do like the Dave Davies approach of let's take this thing over the top, let's have the big sonic orgasm, whereas Brian and Keith and Jumpin' Jack Flash and Street Fighting Man in the bridge, they haze into the ether, and there's this sort of going out of focus that's really powerful and the opposite of what you think, and it's not something the Stones ever did again. Do you think that's fair?
I think it's definitely worth advancing as a theory. By that point, it's hard to know how much of it is Keith, who's absorbed a lot of Brian's mentality, and how much is Brian. But again, you listen to the albums later, and that's like Chaotic Edge, it's taken a different tone as well. And I think there's that kind of exoticism of Beggar's Banquet that makes it a kind of a favorite of mine, you know, that sort of plaintive quality of Sticky Fingers, you know, isn't so much Brian, although who knows, you know, it was Brian who's into that country stuff early on, as far as I recall. He liked Johnny Cash, and I think as well, they used to mock him for liking that country music. And then, of course, later on, they're tapping into it. But it's not a question of necessarily blame, because, as we said, he was a difficult character. But what I do blame is, you know, they treated each other really badly when, you know, when they were 23, 24. Now the guys are in their 70s. They should just give credit where it's due and allow some healing.
Yeah, one thing I think in their defense that's a big factor is the death of Ian Stewart. I feel like in the Stanley Booth book, when Booth talks to Keith and Stu, Stu's apparently present, like virtually every long extended quote from Keith about the history of the band, Stu's right there. And also in the Rolling Stone 1971 interview with Keith, I don't think Keith could have said stuff about Brian that was patently untrue if Stu were alive.
I think that could well be why they've got more vociferous and dismissive about Brian since Stu died. Although, you know, Stu really disliked Brian.
He probably hated him the most.
Yeah, quite kind of rightly, because Stu was kind of a straight guy who turned up, you know. So somebody who's kind of thinks that they're a bit more important and don't have to turn up, which Brian undoubtedly did some of the time, they're a real pain. But, you know, if it was Stu's band, they wouldn't have been a hit.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it's obviously Stu was in some ways a big part of the heart of the Stones, and definitely a factor in their music. But I don't know. It just seems ridiculous to me for Keith to claim that it was Stu's band when it was Brian's band, and he said as much in the early 70s. But you know, yeah, the retroactive history is it's very hard to take, and it makes me sad for Keith, because the tightness of the musical bond between Brian and Keith. I mean, you know, everybody says who was there that was the original engine of the Stones, was that twin guitar aspect of Brian and Keith's playing. And to have that, even if they weren't necessarily personally close for more than a very, you know, much beyond 63, with another time in 66 when they got close again. But that musical relationship, I mean, to me, it's like having lost Brian and having lost Brian as a guitar partner even long before Brian was out of the band, that's got to have scarred Keith deeply.
I think it has scarred him kind of psychically. So I think to some extent he's in denial. And then the other part of it is, as human beings, we kind of often resent people who've given us a break because they've got something over on us. I think it's the... Is a Confucian proverb about, you know, if you save somebody's life, then you're responsible for them. So you've got to be careful about doing it, you know. And Brian gave them their first job. So, you know, that wherever he's looking down on them from, or looking up on them from, you know, wherever he resides now, he probably is thinking, hey, you know, you owe it all to me. And they, you know, and they, he probably would be saying it to them. And they feel that, and it's not an easy kind of feeling to incorporate into your self-image. So, yeah, I think it's a combination of a lot of emotions. You know, I think they loved Brian, I think in their own way at times as well as hated him. And I guess it makes it interesting that they're so obviously damaged. And that's why it frustrates me that really people don't drill into that even more. I mean, I'm off the list. I don't really get to interview the Stones any longer after being Keith's mate for a long time. And I'd really like to sit down and ask him about that stuff. But I think, as Keith's quite sensitive, you know, he's really put on this kind of carapace and does say very, very shockingly callous things. I mean, in the Victor Boccris, Keith Richards' book, he lifts a lot of he uses a lot of my Keith Richards interview with only minimal credit. And at one point Keith said, oh, you know, I started doing this after Brian croaks. And Boccris censored it. He said after Brian died rather than croaked. And, you know, to me that seemed really bizarre, because when you're sitting there with somebody and you're talking about somebody who you cared about, who's kind of a brother, and then you talk about him croaking, and he's just there as a kind of appendage to you, or as a kind of support in that to your own legend, that's pretty hard to accommodate when you're there and you care about people in the way I did. And that's what it was like with Keith. It's strange. And so I want to know what's going on psychically with the guy. But I guess we are all damaged as humans, you know, we carry our baggage, and he's just got more baggage than most of us.
Yeah, and to wrap this up, I want to talk. We haven't talked much about Brian's relationship with Mick, which was much more fraught than Keith. And one thing I noticed in the book, like in the David Bowie biography, you confront the rumors, you know, the allegations by Angie Bowie, David's ex-wife, that he and Mick Jagger, you know, that she caught Mick and David Bowie in bed together, and you debunk that out of hand, but you don't address, to my recollection, the Anita Pallenberg's accusation that, you know, Brian broke the bubble. I mean, it's well documented that Mick had a homosexual fascination with Keith. Marianne Faithfull talks about that a lot. And, you know, there's stories from the Beatles about seeing Mick and Keith in bed together and wondering if something was going on. But Anita Pallenberg told Marianne Faithfull that Brian burst the bubble by consummating that relationship with Mick. Why didn't you get into that in your book?
A good question. I ultimately didn't think it was that credible, because a lot of Anita Pallenberg's stories, as channeled through Marianne, are not reliable at all. I would have liked to have more, you know, I wish I'd found a few more gay lovers of Brian so I could get more on that story. I've only spoken to Keith about it, and I think they experimented, but I somehow couldn't buy into the idea that Mick and Brian did it, because I think they were such egotists, you know, one, you know, so open to mockery from the other, so kind of insecure, both of them. I can't imagine either of them being that open with the other. And I think when Anita talks about it, she, you know, she wasn't there. And, you know, I think there was always this erotic fascination, and Brian was open to doing stuff with other guys. But I think doing it with Mick would have just put him in too vulnerable a position. And I regret saying that, because, you know, it's nice to have more, a more complex web of sexual relationships there. But I don't buy into it. I don't quite believe that Mick shagged Keith, because they use sex as a form of violence, of reinforcing your position, you know, like a bunch of elephant seals might be on a sandy beach somewhere. You know, sex is a weapon, and I can't see them unleashing the weapons on each other. It's too dangerous.
Well, yeah, and in your book, you for you, the big moment that broke, or that where Mick Jagger established permanent dominance over Brian Jones, which he hadn't had up to that point, was in 63 when he bragged behind her back that he had seduced Brian's baby mama, Pat Andrews. And Brian falls for that, and his response is to seduce Keith's girlfriend, who was a virgin, and to take her virginity. I mean, that to me was a really powerful bit of psychodrama and really shocking manipulation on Mick's part for such a young person.
Absolutely. I mean, it's quite horrifying in a way, and it's just using women as chattels. And but that's what happens, you know. There's something very unhealthy about the Stones. What, you know, I didn't like being around the Stones, around Mick's people. I felt there was something very unhealthy about his attitude to young women. You know, the best, the most flattering depiction is that it's vampiric, but who knows how we're going to get to the bottom of, you know, what's happened with Mick and his various women. And, you know, there's a real nastiness about that story. And yes, sex was used as a form of dominance. And I found it shocking the first time I sat down with Pat Andrews. She talked about that, and it's something that's dominated her entire life. You know, it really has spoiled her life, you know, and I really, really felt for her. You know, she finds it very hard to move on from all those nasty little claims that were made back in 1963, or it might have been early. It was very early anyway. But yeah, it's, those things are very brutal and very nasty, and it did go on. And I suppose the only good part of it is that it kind of somehow fed into the music and gave it an edge and a kind of dark magic it wouldn't have had otherwise. But yeah, it's beyond nasty.
And so to wrap it up, like, what if you could put your storytelling about Brian Jones's life into one sentence for fans, what would you want people to take away from your work on Brian and Brian's work as a musician?
I think it's coming back to what we said at the beginning, that Brian was the first to kind of spot this sound, this dark, dense, dangerous R&B sound, which you can hear in the slide guitar of Elmore James, or you can hear it in that spiky guitar of Hubert Sumlin, or in the sort of haunted voice of Robert Johnson. And this was kind of incredibly niche art music for a few kind of people into really esoteric sounds. And he unleashed that. He took the cork out. He unleashed this cornucopia of sounds that are all around us now. So I think there's something about the tonality of the Western world today and the sounds we hear. And Brian was the first one who uncorked it all and made it happen. And, you know, it's bigger than the Stones alone. The Stones kind of powered a lot of British R&B and then a lot of American garage rock, but it goes beyond that. Brian just, you know, he unleashed the sound of Pan on the world, and we can still hear it today.
Well, awesome. And that was Paul Trinka, author of Brian Jones. It's called The Making of the Rolling Stones in the U.S. and it's Sympathy for the Devil in the U.K., as well as the author of David Bowie's Starman, Iggy, Open Up and Bleed, and Portrait of the Blues. And hopefully we can have you back on the show to talk more in depth about some of those other books sometime.
Absolutely. Well, thanks, Nate. You asked some really interesting questions. I enjoyed that a lot. And it is, it's a great story. And what can I say? I was lucky, you know, it's good the stories are out there, and I felt lucky to kind of journey around this planet and try and depict it as in all of its glory and messiness. So thanks a lot.
Well, thank you. And thanks for documenting it.
Take care. Thanks again.
You too. Thanks, Paul. Thanks for listening. Next week, join Paul Trinka and I again for a discussion of his biography of Iggy Pop. Be sure and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com to access the YouTube playlists and hear the music we're talking about. Paul Trinka's Iggy, Open Up and Bleed, is available from Three Rivers Press, wherever fine books are sold.